Donald Trump's list of enemies is possibly the one thing longer than his list of indictments. But to run a successful presidential campaign, he's going to need at least a few friends around him. Who's going to be his running mate, and who are going to be the Machiavellian movers and shakers behind the scenes? I'm Jacob Jarvis, and here to discuss this with me is Politico's senior political columnist and politics bureau chief, Jonathan Martin. Welcome to the bunker, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me. It really sounds better with an English accent.
When it comes to people who might want to be Trump's potential vice president then, so in 2016, Mike Pence was pretty key in winning over evangelicals and in turn the presidency. But, you know, his time in the White House culminated in Trump supporters calling for him to be hanged. Would you have to be pretty naive or stupid to kind of really want to be Donald Trump's running mate?
Ambition's a powerful drug, and that is certainly the case when it comes to American politics. And a lot of Republicans may be conscious of the obvious downside of being Trump's running mate, but they see more upside, right?
Yeah.
They want that rocket ship to fame and prominence and potentially the presidency themselves. So there's plenty of thirsty Republicans, as the kids say, who are eager to take that risk.
Is the curiosity, though, there, the kind of short-sightedness that last time out there were quite a few sensible people who tied themselves to Trump, and it obviously didn't work out well for them. But I suppose at that point, no one knew what a Trump presidency would be like.
As they say about divorce and remarriage, it's the triumph of hope over experience. Yeah. These guys, at some level, they know that buying the Trump ticket is more likely to cause them grief, could get them some serious lawyer's fees. But if you're Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, or Lee Stefanik, the congresswoman from New York, this is your ticket, right? Like, you're never going to win a primary for president in your own right. This is the path, and it's worth the risk in their eyes.
So. Who is in the running to be his pick then this time out?
It's hard to know what is in Trump's head, but I'll tell you what I think the criteria are. I think the criteria is somebody that he can totally control, somebody that's not going to pose a threat to him, that's not going to project their own independence, and, you know, somebody who will, in short, not be Mike Pence, right? I think he also wants somebody that he has a level of respect for. Trump, for all of his bombast and inflammatory conduct, he's kind of a snob. He likes people around him who he thinks are of a certain level and skill, and he's quite taken with appearances. That matters, too.
Yeah.
I mentioned Noem in South Dakota, at least Stefanik, the congressman from New York. I think Tim Scott, senator from South Carolina, is obviously somebody that could be on the list. Marco Rubio from Florida, possibly. Maybe Katie Britt from Alabama. Those are, to me, the obvious names right now.
Who do you think it would be kind of the most tactically astute for him to pick out of those names?
I think Tim Scott would obviously be able to appeal to some black men, which could, you know, shave off Biden's advantage with that demographic, which is significant. I think Katie Britt, somebody that you can send to every suburb in the country, right? And she could have appeal.
So Nikki Haley has said she doesn't want to be vice president, and I'm sure Trump doesn't want to pick her, but wouldn't, in, you know, some sort of bizarro world where he's not as petty as he is, wouldn't it make sense to pick Nikki Haley?
Of course. No, that's the tradition in American politics, is the runner-up often is the front-runner for VP. And under more normal circumstances where this party wasn't so fractured, this would be an obvious way to unify the party differences. And also for Trump, get somebody who has obvious vote-getting appeal and could, like Brett, go into suburban America and be a pretty good face for the party.
When it comes to the cabinet, then, has he also dragged down the quality of candidates that he will have at his disposal there compared to the first time that he was able to pick that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. We just talked about a lot. Who was going to be willing to serve in a Trump second term, right? And there are, I mean, going to be less people, certainly from the business world, who are not going to want to touch the Trump cabinet. We'll still find people. Like, there's going to be plenty of people in elected office currently who are bored, restless, hungry, whatever, and believe that they could be secretary of something, and that's a better gig, even if it's for Trump. In some ways, especially if it's for Trump, because they create their own power base and really have an impact on policy in ways that in a more conventional administration, they wouldn't have.
Some people might be attracted then to the vacuum that has been created because there seems to be a vacuum of talent around him. Some people might think they can fill that.
Totally. And also, they know that Trump isn't that interested in a lot of the actual substance. And so that, you know, they could go in there and actually have an impact on some of those issues, you know.
At the moment, we've been speaking about Team Trump, but I know that he is taking a heavy hand on the Republican National Committee. Could you just talk me through a little bit about what's going on there and how heavy handed he's being?
So it's traditional for whoever the party nominee is to take control of the National Party. So that's not terribly different. What is different here is Trump effectively running off the elected chair of the party during the course of her term. And by the way, somebody who was not exactly like a Bush Republican, Trump appointed her effectively. This is Ronna McDaniel. So that's what's different. And obviously installing a state party chair as national chair, who you mostly like because he's willing to perpetuate your stolen election bullshit. That's different. And, you know, installing your daughter-in-law with scant political experience obviously is a little different, although Reagan's daughter, we should know Marine Reagan, had the same job in the 80s. So, yeah, in some ways, not abnormal, but in other ways, perfectly Trumpy.
How do you see his family fitting into the campaign this time?
You know, I think it'll be complicated. Let's start with his wife, who's got no apparent interest.
Seems to have no interest in being seen anywhere near Donald Trump, from my perspective.
Right. So his daughter and her husband seem to be more interested in making money right now. Yeah, his two sons are more interested in the campaign, especially Don Jr., who's the most political in the family. And obviously, Eric's married to the now co-chairman of the RNC. But no, this is like a family affair. And you know what was interesting about the first Trump administration is, you know, so many countries, especially the autocracies, they were happy to do business with Jared Kushner because, like, to them, they recognized this setup. Oh, the foreign secretary isn't the one who actually has the real power. It's the son-in-law. Like, you know, they've seen that movie before. You know, it was so different from the American tradition, but it kind of was like very familiar to a lot of countries around the world. I'm not sure Jared will have the same portfolio this time around, but I'm sure that the family's going to be in the mix and you'll have interest in America and abroad who will try to go around the traditional levers of power by talking to the family.
When it came to foreign policy, last time out, it seemed like Jared Kushner was maybe one of the few people in the Trump administration who had at least some sort of logic to what he was doing and some kind of policy ideal. Would someone like him be quite a big miss to Trump when it comes to that side of things?
I mean, it depends, right? Like, you could have folks who were much more experienced in policy affairs, who've got a stronger perspective on the world than Jared Kushner had, who was basically a real estate guy. Now, the question is, do they have their own independent authority, or are they going to be basically undercut by members of the family again? You know, that's sort of the question.
Hmm. Are there any people from the first time he ran for president who aren't involved this time that you think Donald Trump could miss? You know, there's some pretty big characters like Steve Bannon and Roger Stone, for example, who don't seem as close to it this time in a way that they were last time he won.
They're still around. They're just not in the day-to-day, but they're still at the periphery because Trump never really gets rid of his people for good. But no, it's a more professionalized campaign operation now, with people that Trump has a degree of trust in because of how they came through the Republican primary. So that's definitely different. Look, if he is president again, they'll come in much more prepared and they'll have more obvious people for a lot of these slots than they had in 2016.
In his team this time out, then, is there anyone that's maybe going under the radar who you think is particularly important in the way he's operating that perhaps people like myself who aren't as invested in Washington as you are might not notice?
Well, the biggest difference is that he's got two people with extensive political experience running his campaign, Chris LoCivito and Susie Wiles. They're in charge of the campaign this time. And that's different from with the kind of gallery of people last time around. That's the most important distinction. Now, what do those folks do if Trump wins? Will they still be factors? And also, the bigger question is just like, how much can Trump be controlled generally, right? You can have all the advisors in the world, but he's still going to be Donald Trump.
Is there anyone it feels like he does really listen to? Is there anyone who has his ear particularly at the moment?
I said a minute ago, I think La Sabida and Wiles earned capital with Trump by, you know, running a strong campaign in the primary. They took his advice not to do any of the primary debates. It worked out well. He marginalized his opponents, and he won a third consecutive nomination without breaking a sweat. So that has put them in pretty good stead right now.
Cool. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate speaking to you.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
After speaking to Jonathan a few days ago, I was intrigued by some of the names he mentioned, and I thought it might be interesting to dig into some of them in a little more detail. So joining me for a rare second half to this bunker is producer and Bunker USA mastermind, Chris Jones. Hello, mate. Fancy seeing you here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on with you, Jov. Absolutely honoured to be here with you. Love what you do. Love the show.
Thank you, mate. I'll slip you that £10 afterwards. The top names that Jonathan mentioned were Kristi Noem, Elise Stefanik, and Tim Scott. I want you to give me a little mini profile on each of them, please. So let's start with Kristi Noem. What does she do now?
I'll do my best. She's the governor of South Dakota. She was apparently re-elected in 2022 with the largest ever tally of votes in South Dakota to history. She got about 62%, which is pretty massive. One of her mottos, I guess, for South Dakota is open for business. So she's right up there, kind of on the same wavelength as Trump in that respect. But before she's a politician, she's a rancher, a farmer, and a small business owner.
Okay.
So she's hella American.
Yeah, she's trying to really hit all of the sort of... she couldn't be more American unless she was a bald eagle.
Yeah, exactly. She's really trying her best. She's hyping herself up in the most American way. Some of the things she's done, she's eased up COVID-19 restrictions before other governors. She supported Donald Trump's election fraud claims as well, which is massive. And she's also very involved within the culture war sphere. So she's banned some of the teaching of critical race theory in some schools. And she's had some legal battles with trans rights groups too. So most recently, she was forced to apologize after she canceled the contract of a community health worker assigned to the Transformation Project. And she's had to pay out about $300,000 because of that. So a fairly massive sum. So she gets herself into some shit as well.
Yeah, so I mean, that sounds completely like Trump if she supported January 6th and is now skint for pissing people off. What are her odds looking like?
Well, I was looking at Odds Checker just to say all of these are Odds Checker, and her rating is around about 18.18%. So she's actually right up there at the top with the other candidates. So she looks like she could be a likely vice president for Trump. And one thing we do know as well is that Trump likes her. Oh my God, he likes her. Yeah. He actually said at Ohio rally not too long ago that she was beautiful.
Oh,
isn't
God.
That lovely?
Everything he says just has such an air of creep around it, doesn't it?
It really does.
So now moving on to Elise Stefanik. What does she do now and what's her vibe?
Yeah, she's a congresswoman. She represents New York's 21st district. And she's actually the youngest woman ever to be elected to the House in US history. Just to kind of give you something slightly different, she was also one of the 147 members of Congress who signed to not certify Biden's election win in 2020.
Okay, so she's passing the loyalty tests.
Mm.
What's she like as a person?
I think she's quite boring, if I'm honest.
Okay.
I think she's quite boring. Some of her priorities, so as a politician, they're quite straightforward, but very much, again, aligned with Trump. So some of her priorities, creating jobs and economic opportunities is one, protecting Social Security, Medicare, and other critical programs for North Country seniors and future generations. Another one is strengthening America's immigration system and border security. Now, we know that's a big part of Donald Trump's campaign. He says he wants to create the biggest deportation exercises in US history if he gets into office. So we can imagine that she'll be really strong on that if Trump does give her the VP role. But then there's something else. She wants to fight to deliver solutions to lower the cost of prescription drugs. It's easy for you to say. And this is something that I do want to pick up on, because this is something that the GOP has used to target Biden over and over again. The cost of prescription drugs, again, easy for you to say. If we look at diabetes, for example, and insulin, millions of people have diabetes in the US. And I think about 7 million rely on it prescriptively. basically just to stay alive. And the cost of it here in the UK of a vial is around about $7, $7. If you look at that comparatively in the US, it's about $100. It's mental, Jarv. Jarv, it's bloody mental.
I mean, it's strange, but then also seen as a pretty anti-Medicare seems like a weird point to pick Biden up on.
But the thing is, Biden has tried, maybe someone would argue he could try it harder. He's tried to lower the cost for those on Medicare. I think he's tried to lower it to about $35 max as a cap. But that's only for a certain number of people. There are still lots of people paying extortionate amounts for their prescriptive drugs like insulin. But at the same time, the president doesn't control the cost of prescriptive drugs. That's for the manufacturer. So you'd think that this is something that Stefanik perhaps would be positive about for Biden, and perhaps the GOP in general would be positive about it. But no, they've chosen to use this as a weapon, and that's one of the things that she says she wants to deliver on. Whether she'll be able to do it, whether Trump will do it, well, really remains to be seen.
One of the better-known people on the list then, so onto Tim Scott. Tell me a little bit about him.
Yeah, he's interesting because he is this kind of encapsulation of the American dream, I guess. He's someone who came from poverty. He didn't have a great start in life. In fact, on his own website, he says that he failed at four of his first classes in his freshman year of high school, and then got his act together. I think he met someone in a Chick-fil-A, which is an American fast food chain. I don't think they have it here.
Well, I know he pushed back against the State of the Union address the other year, didn't he? He was the GOP person who gave the response to one of Biden's State of the Union. So he's clearly a big figure for them.
Yeah. Oh, and one thing we know about Tim Scott is he flipping loves money. He does. So he's pulled himself out of poverty. I think one of his mottos or something that he said his mentor told him was to think his way out of poverty, which I think is a bit of an oversimplification, to be honest with you, to give other people that advice. But, you know, he's managed it. He's a very rich man now. And
he's a senator.
He's a senator of South Carolina, we should say. And he likes money. And one of the things that he's most proud of, and he said this over and over again, is the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, which was brought in 2017. I'm not going to go into the detail, not just because I don't understand it, but essentially it's well boring and it delivers more money for the rich than for those kind of stuck in the middle class and the lower classes. A classic kind of GOP economic solution, I guess. But that's something that he says he's very, very proud of. But like you say, he's a name that we've been watching out for a long time and put himself forward for the candidacy. I don't think he ever got above fifth place, really. He was kind of hovering between fifth and eighth. Didn't get the candidacy. And now it looks like he's potentially, up there for vice president for Trump.
Well, what are his odds?
So his are around about 11.11%. So he's also up there. He's one of the favorites in the top three. We should also say that Elise Stefanik, hers are around about 10.14%. So she's up there as well. But Tim Scott just kind of pipping her at the moment.
So among those, it's Noam top, then Scott, then Stefanik when it comes to
pretty much.
So there's also a name which came out actually after I spoke with Jonathan, someone who people will be familiar with, but is seeming to get a little bit more momentum. There were a few news reports after I had that initial chat. So Tulsi Gabbard is another person getting a lot of traction. Can you talk me through a little bit of her? So she was a Democrat at some point, I believe.
Yes, she was. This is a really surprising case. And I can't quite understand why or what happened to her, because she was described as a rising star of the Democrat Party. She was the youngest person ever elected to Hawaii State Legislature. She also served in the military, went to Iraq for 12 months. So all of that sounds pretty good, right?
Well, it sounds exactly like the sort of person maybe the Democrats could do with if they were to ever look for a Biden alternative.
Yeah, and if you were ever loyalist of hers while she was in the Democrats, then frankly, you've been made to look like a bit of an idiot because she announced that she was leaving the party pretty harshly. Actually, this is what she said.
I can no longer remain in today's Democratic Party that's under the complete control of an elitist cabal of warmongers who are driven by cowardly wokeness.
She also went on Donald Trump Jr.'s podcast recently. Didn't really know he had a podcast, if I'm honest with you.
No, he's really big on it in terms of being a weapon. I mean, you can use that word in loads of ways, really. He's a complete weapon, but he is a weapon for Donald Trump in pushing just even the stuff that... It's interesting how he really kind of shaped Donald Trump's way of thinking in a lot of ways, or at least his way of communicating, but he's obviously a little bit too raw, which sounds silly compared to Trump.
Yeah, but he put to her, what if Donald Trump came to you and said, do you want to be my vice president? What would you say? And she said she'd be honored. So she really wants this, I think. She really wants this vice president role, which is such a massive switch from where she was at the start of her career. She's kind of just flipped completely around, gone complete 180. And I think that's garnered a lot of criticism for her, where a lot of people have said that she's just simply a grifter, basically. She's someone who is out for herself, someone who is only looking out for her own career and wants to push herself, propel herself as far forward as possible. Do I think she has a chance? I think she does. I think if you look at how she performs in front of a microphone on TV, she's pretty strong, military-like, I would say, really clear in her messaging. And I think she's someone who would back Donald Trump in a really strong and impressive way, I think is fair to say. I think she's a good talker. So I think she does have a chance. I think Ozchecker has her around 4.3% at the moment, but that did jump quite massively from about 1% in just a matter of a couple of days. And I expect that to probably rise a bit more as well.
Completely. And you never know who Trump's going to. There was an interview with Trump actually recently where he said he has started to rule some names out. So obviously people like Vivek Ramaswamy looks like has been completely ruled out. So you never really know, do you, at this moment? People can boost very high, or people could all be just completely written off.
And that was a massive surprise, actually, for me, that Ramaswamy has kind of just been shoved out of the way, because you look at him on paper, he's very similar to Trump, has very similar morals, young and upcoming, could potentially be, you know, a real tool for Trump to use for good. But maybe he's too young, maybe he's too inexperienced. And also, he's just a bit of a bastard, isn't he?
Well, on that note, Chris, thank you very much for talking me through that.
My God, you're welcome.
And listeners, thank you for listening to The Bunker. Remember, if you enjoy what we do, we really could do with your support. For £3 a month, you can back us on Patreon and you'll get all of our episodes ad-free and early. There's a link in the show notes, or search Bunker Patreon Podcast to find out how. I'm Jacob Jarvis. Thank you for listening to The Bunker.
The Bunker USA was written and presented by Podmaster's Managing Editor, Jacob Jarvis, with Chris Jones. The audio producer was me, Jade Bailey, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison, with music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott. The Bunker is a Podmaster's production.